Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to go birding this hour. Then at 10 o'clock, national correspondent Bob Ney joins me before he heads off to India for a couple of weeks. And then Allison Novak of 7 Days will hang out at the University Mall for a bit. And we'll finish the week with some open phones at 10:30. But let's begin the morning prepping for the return of our avian population. I should start with a tip of the beak for those birds that hung out here all winter to keep us company. But now they're getting some serious company, and so are we. Joining me to guide us as the birds are back in town is Audubon Vermont conservation biologist Margaret Fowl. Margaret, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we also have Jillian Liner, Audubon Vermont's conservation director. Jillian, great to have you on the show this morning.
Hi, Rick. Very happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. Listeners, to ask our guests about birds or to share what you've seen so far, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can let us know where you like to go to see the birds coming back to the north. You can email us, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Margaret, it's a lot of work to migrate. Why do the birds bother?
Well, that's a great question, Rick. I mean, there are lots of theories. The main theory is that they move for resources, so food and breeding opportunities. So up here, there's less competition with resident birds on the wintering grounds, and it's a way for them to kind of spread out and find habitat that they need and the food they need in order to breed.
And they tend to go back to the same area or general area, in the winter. They tend to come back to the same here in the spring. So how do they know where to go?
Well, so there's a huge amount of variation in terms of how birds migrate, where they migrate, it's not that simple. Some birds know where to go. It's an instinctive thing. A lot of them use various cues, like even the stars to migrate. A lot of our migratory birds migrate at night, so they're using the stars to navigate. Some are using magnetic fields to find their way, but they're not taught by their parents in most cases. They are hardwired to make some of these long journeys. I don't know if you have anything to add, Jillian.
No, that's right. It's instinctive. Over, hundreds of years, these birds have adapted and evolved to migrate, and it's in their genes.
Wow. Well, Jillian, I know some, as I mentioned, stick around, and I'm happy we have birds here in the winter, but are those birds that have migrated south, or do we have birds who love Vermont so much that they just can't stand to leave us in the winter?
There are definitely some species that are, I'll say, hardy enough to stick around during the winter. And mainly it's the birds that they can find, like Margaret was saying earlier, that they can find food. And as long as they can find food, they will stay. Like, there's crows, there's yeah, jays, there's chickadees. There's a handful of birds that will stay and many that will move. Some really long distance migrants, they'll travel down to South America. There's other birds that will make shorter trips. Margaret and I were just talking the other day, just actually American robin, which is, one of the most common birds that we might see. If you start looking into their migratory patterns, they're pretty unique and flexible, which might be the reason why we find them so many places. But some of them will stick around. Others will congregate and go short distances, sometimes east or west. And it's all based on food. Some will migrate one year and not the other. That's a very flexible bird.
So growing up in Pennsylvania, Jillian, when we saw the first robin, we knew it was spring. That was the harbinger. That was, what we said, okay, oh, saw a robin today, so it must be spring. I have no idea why we thought that, but the other day I was in Hinesburg, saw a robin, and boom, in my head I thought, oh, well, winter's over because I just saw a robin. Is that just some crazy fallacy, or is there some amount of reason for me being wired that way?
I feel the same way, and the robins just returned to my backyard. Again, there's some people who will say, wait, I have robins all, you know, here year round, so that's not my sign of spring. But I think for a lot of us, it's true, and it's been true. And so, yeah, no, I'm with you. The robins just returned to my yard, and a little warmer weather, and things are greening up a little bit, and it's spring.
All right. So, Margaret, I know crows. Joanne mentioned chickadees. The raptors, you know, are here during the winter. We can be pretty harsh, you know, our winters here. Sub-zero temperatures, heavy snows, ice storms. When it gets really brutal, how do they survive and protect themselves to get through the harshest of our winter weather?
Well, they have a lot of physiological abilities to do that. Some are able to, there's a shunting mechanism in their feet that keeps them from being, the feet getting frostbitten. So raptors have that. It's too complicated for me to explain.
That's all right. Yeah.
Cool. And then they can puff up their feathers, give them more sort of air pockets to keep themselves warm. So a lot of times on a really cold day, you might see, you know, a chickadee all poofed up, and he's trying to, or she's trying to keep himself warm. They hunker down. They find especially softwood trees where they can get protection from the wind. Some will even go in cavities in order to protect themselves from the weather. So they have a lot of ways of surviving. You know, the important thing for them is finding food. And on winters where we have a really high snow cover or deep snow cover or long stretches of cold weather, especially icy snow on top, birds like owls have a hard time finding food because they're looking for the rodents that are under the snow. So if there's a layer of ice on top, it's hard for them to hear the rodents underneath. Because believe it or not, they can hear them moving around under the snow. So there are some winters that are harder on these species than others, and fortunately they can fly. So they may leave temporarily to find food. They can be flexible, so that helps them as well.
Jillian, which birds think that Vermont is a balmy destination during the winter and are actually migrating from the north to Vermont for, you know, as their southern swing?
There's birds like some waterfowl will pass through here. I mean, they continue on their way. There's some owls that will drop down, like mm-hmm. the snowy owl, that will come down here and winter.
Did we see a lot of snowy owls this past winter?
We saw just a few. Some years we have a lot, but there was not a huge movement of snowy owls down here this year. It depends on their food resources up north.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of cyclical. Some years we'll get a lot of them, especially when they have a really good food year in the Arctic where they breed. And then they've got so many young that there's competition for food in the winter. And so we tend to get the young birds, the first-year birds or second-year birds, that come down looking for food in the winter. But this was not a big one for us. Similarly, we also get red poles, common red poles,
which
is a type of finch. And that is also on a cyclical cycle. And I think only a handful of them were seen this year. Last year, we had a lot moving down in the winter.
And, Margaret, you mentioned that they like to, when they do migrate, and I would imagine, you know, heading south and now coming back north, many migrate at night, although we see some during the day. But, you know, first of all, why would some birds migrate during the day? Why some at night? And the fact that they can use the stars absolutely blows me away. So explain a little more about that.
Yeah, so I don't know too much about how they use the stars. I think the general thought is that it's usually less windy at night, although if you live in Huntington like I do, last night was not one of those nights. And usually less windy. They're going to migrate on a clear night. They want sort of a light breeze helping them push north. But there are just fewer things blocking their way at night. And so that tends to be what's easiest for them. I don't know if you have anything to add, Jillian, on that. But
Yes, there's less predators at night, and they do use the stars to navigate. That's part of the reason why light pollution. I don't know if many of your listeners have heard about some of the lights out campaigns in some urban areas, but nocturnal migrants, a lot of them are passerines, so the smaller songbirds that migrate at night, they use lights, and they are drawn to areas, urban areas that have a lot of light, and there's been studies that have shown that, and as they get drawn, they can get exhausted and also collide with buildings. So there are efforts now across the country. Actually, New York City just passed a law to prevent turnout lights, dim lights, during the peak migration periods, both in spring and fall. So there's an awareness for this, and everybody notices the impact that it can have and are trying to take steps to reduce that threat to migrant birds.
Oh, interesting. Well done, NYC, on the Lights Out campaign. How much energy is needed for these birds, especially the ones that go long distances to migrate?
Tremendous amount of energy. And actually, what Margaret was talking about earlier in terms of the physiological traits that are super unique to some of these birds is what allows them to do it. I think if we as humans were able to do some of what they could do, we would be superheroes. Some of these birds, what's really important to them when they start their migration is getting super fat and building their muscles up. Some of them do long distance migrations and don't stop. They'll do them for multiple days. Many of you, your listeners might have heard about the barred-tailed godwit, which is a bird that breeds up in Alaska in the Yukon, but then migrates all the way down to New Zealand. And they tracked that bird using this really cool technology, geolocators, which allow the birds to be tracked via satellites. And they put a geolocator on one of the a female. And they were amazed to learn that she did a nonstop flight. It was over 7,000 miles in about, I think it was 8 days, and not stopping. And it just, they ended up, as they look at these birds and figure out how they can do it, it's that they eat so much food, I mean, feed nonstop before they take these long flights. They're able to accumulate muscle in a way that we aren't. We have to like lift weights or go exercise or beef up. They just have to eat. They accumulate muscle and then they accumulate a tremendous amount of fat. And then as they make these long journeys, they burn through that fat. And even are able to sleep on the wing. They're able to do a shut down half their brain and let half their brain sleep. While the other half is awake and flip-flop, do that back and forth so that they're able to make these long journeys. So, yeah, it's an incredible feat. They're all doing it, right? All these traits, they've evolved just to be able to survive. But they're amazing.
Jillian, we can't even handle flying cross country nonstop in a plane, you know, with amenities and food, and that is an incredible story of that journey. Oh my, I'm just blown away by that. All right, Margaret, time to explore what birds we're seeing right now here in Vermont that are migrating at this point.
Yeah, so right now it's kind of the short-distance migrants that are appearing, so ones that haven't maybe gone as far as South America or Central America. So we're seeing, I think last week or so, started to see eastern phoebes in my yard. The first sort of short-distance migrants that we typically see are red-winged blackbirds, and those arrived, at least here where I live, in early March, And then grackles kind of came along with them. I also, a couple weeks ago, had my first woodcock. So these birds are coming from south of here in North America, not from some other continent or other part of the world. But I think white-throated sparrows are probably starting to arrive.
I had a white-throated sparrow.
Oh, there we go.
And pretty soon, you know, it's what, second, it's only the first week of April, so gradually we'll start to see some other species. The first probably long-distance migrant that we'll see is the broad-winged hawk. They migrate to South America, and they typically arrive in April. And they're really the only hawk in Vermont that does this long-distance migration. They time their migration, at least it appears to me, with the wood frog nesting.
Interesting.
When wood frogs are in the ponds and in the pools, they tend to be around. And the wood frogs just moved in recently, so I bet I'll see a broadwing pretty soon.
Love it. Let's go to the phones. We've got Wade joining us from Corinth. Hi, Wade.
Hey, good morning. Good morning to your guest. And I just have a quick question, and then I'll hang up and listen to the answer. Observed a lot of large groups of robins throughout the entire winter, and especially during a couple of those bigger snowstorms we had in both January and February. And is that abnormal? And I'll hang up and listen.
All right, Julian, I'm going to keep the robin questions going to you. So Wade saw large groups of robins through the winter this year. Is that abnormal for our area?
Yeah, so like I was saying earlier in the program, it's not highly unusual. It might seem unusual in a particular area if you haven't seen them before. But robins will congregate. They'll congregate in large flocks, and then they went to where they could find food. So depending if he saw those in his backyard, in his neighborhood, or in a particular area, those birds were there because there was some sort of food source. And if it was in the middle of the winter when there's a lot of snow, it was some sort of berry, most likely, that was still remaining on, you know, a vine or a shrub. Yeah. They probably, if it's in the middle of winter when food sources are especially rare, the flocks will be even larger. I mean, those birds will be finding that source of food and congregating there.
All right. Margaret, we had another caller who couldn't stay on the line, and it was another bird-specific question. Says in her 80-plus years has never seen a bluebird in Vermont. Is she just looking in the wrong spots, or do we not get bluebirds here in Vermont?
Yeah, so I would think she's unlucky. There are bluebirds. Not knowing where she is, depends, but she's just maybe being unlucky. They're typically in open habitat, but they can be in sort of more suburban habitat. They're not going to be up in the mountains so much, so they're going to be, I have them here in Huntington, which is kind of the mountains, but I have some open habitat here at my house. So I think just persevering. And one way to find out where other people are seeing robins or bluebirds is eBird, which is a web-based platform where people report their sightings, and you can actually search by species. So if you go to eBird, you have to set up an account, but it's free, and you could search bluebirds in Vermont and find out where other people are seeing them, and probably you'd be guaranteed to be able to go somewhere and find the bluebirds.
All right, so to our listener, come down from the mountain is the first recommendation. Second recommendation, if you're not tech savvy, get one of the grandkids to get you onto eBird and find out where you can actually find them here in Vermont. Back to the phones. We're going to head to Bristol this time and speak with Fred. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. Fred from Bristol. Hey, I have a question for the guest speakers. I would like to attract or have purple martins at my property, and I have a martin house up, and I wondered if you guys or gals can give me some suggestions on how to get them to come there, or do I just wait it out, or am I putting it in the right place? What do I need to do? Thank you.
Margaret, how does Fred attract purple martins? He's got the martin house there. He's got a welcome sign. Put out the welcome mat. What's going on?
Well, we don't have that many purple martins in Vermont. We did a purple martin blitz a few years ago, and typically they're really pretty low in the Champlain Valley. They tend to be near the lake. So being in Bristol, it may be that you're just not, you're too high up. They're not a species that's very common here. So it also may be that you just aren't having, you don't have any close enough to your property. I am not that familiar with purple martins and, like, how you would attract them to a house. It's possible that there's resources online for that. But I know you could, you know, there's possibly you could play purple martin songs on your phone or something, or you set up a speaker. That might do something, but generally I think they're more, they're closer to the lake. You might want to try to do something like attract tree swallows or some other, what we call aerial insectivore, that are more likely to be in your part of the state. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Jillian.
Yeah, they like to be around, and you might have this in Bristol. They do like to be around wet areas, you know, open water, for the reason that Margaret just described. They're insectivores and kind of tend to be areas where there'll be a lot of insects. But certainly the proximity you are to a nearby, you know, where they are known to be is going to be a huge help, because it's possible that as the birds, you know, if there's a lot of them, they disperse and they're looking for new places, they might find your hotel. But more likely if you're already in close proximity to them.
All right. Well, Fred, you might be just out of luck, or you might just have to shift your location, find a new property closer to a water source. We're spending the hour dedicated to ornithology with Margaret Fowle and Jillian Liner, and we're going to take a break for CBS News. When we get back, we're still going to take calls, so you can get in the queue now, 802-244-1777. Or 877-291-8255. Email address vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Coming up today at 12:05, we've got the Sox opener from Yankee Stadium. First pitch at 1:05. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Yesterday at this time, we were learning about reptiles and amphibians, and our guest, Jim Andrews, mentioned that birds are reptiles, but he deferred to those with an ornithology background to tell us about birds, and that's what we're up to this morning. Margaret Fowle and Jillian Liner of Audubon, Vermont, sharing their knowledge, answering your questions about the wonderful birds we see here in Vermont. You can join in by calling 802-244-1777. 877-291-8255. The email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Just before the break, we heard from Fred in Bristol, who was dying to see some purple martins. I got to tell you, I just looked them up because I wasn't familiar with them. They're gorgeous birds. I want to put up a martin house and move close to the water to try to attract some. Let's go to our next caller, and it's Steve from Hinesburg. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Great.
I just want to talk to you about, or tell you about an experience that I had a few years ago. Wife and I, it was in the fall, leaf peeping. Wife and I were coming back from Middlebury, and we were on a back road. We came upon a little rise, and there was a house there and a couple of maple trees on the lawn. And as we crested the hill, a whole flock of birds came out of that tree, out of those trees, and surrounded our vehicle. We were like right in the middle of that flock. And
wow.
It lasted probably a second, maybe a second and a half, but it was just unbelievable. I'd never seen anything before and haven't since.
Oh, my.
It was unbelievable.
Were you able to identify any of the birds that you saw, or was it just too quick?
I think they were probably, I don't know exactly what they were, but they were all in one flock, and there were hundreds and hundreds of them.
Wow, Steve.
It was really, really unreal.
Yeah, what a great experience. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
Margaret, have you heard of anything like that before, where a flock of birds would, you know, circle around a car in that kind of a number?
Well, not necessarily around a car, but there is a species called the European starling that collects in these large flocks, and they move in these amazing formations. You can look them up online.
Yeah.
They're called murmurations. And I think there's a recent posting of some video of these murmurations. It's like this moving blob in the air.
Yep.
Just beautiful. I don't know. It's beautiful to watch. And they do tend to roost in trees when they're not flying around. Yep. So maybe something, when you drove by, something spooks them and they flew and they just happen to kind of stay in a group around your car. It's hard to describe. It's hard to know why they did that then in that particular moment. But yeah, for anyone who wants to see an amazing pattern of huge flocks of birds, it can be thousands sometimes moving in the air. It's really cool. So look it up.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I've seen it, and the experience it's surreal. It's almost like synchronized swimming, but instead of a team of whatever, 10 swimmers or something, it is hundreds of birds kind of moving in a wave, diving in and out around each other in perfect, orchestration. It really is beautiful. Let's take another call from Phil, who joins us from Berlin. Hi, Phil.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I've been enjoying the aerial woodcock display, which is quite fantastic if you've never seen it. But my question is, that's usually at dusk, but my question is there are woodcocks that populate the dirt road in front, and it's in the daytime, and it looks like they're strutting. This very peculiar behavior.
Yes. All right.
So I wonder, is that a male or a female?
All right.
In the daytime that is doing that strut.
All right, Phil, great question. Jillian, are you familiar with the woodcock? I went once to see the mating dance and call, and it is absolutely incredible. Can you explain what Phil's been seeing on the dirt road there?
Yeah, that is a mating display, and you can see it a lot around this time of year. Margaret mentioned these are one of the first. Oh, great! Now I have a chainsaw going on out my window. they are one of the first birds to come back, and they use open areas, including roads, to do their mating display. And it is one of most people who are able to see it want to just come back and see it again and again. And they have that funny strut, and they do have that flight up in the air and the little twittering, cool noises that they make.
Yep.
And so it's great that he's able to see that and he has it nearby. Woodcock, actually, they are a declining species, and they need a variety of habitat. So the other thing, they need that open habitat, but they also need association with some forested habitat. And it's a bird that Audubon is active in trying to identify the places where we can enhance habitat and create that right mix for them and attract more of them. So, yeah, that's a good spring bird.
Yeah. Now, when they're on the ground, and it would be the male, I think, right, trying to attract the female.
Yeah, the male's the one, I think, doing the little dance. We have people at Audubon that like to imitate the woodcock dance. This is kind of fun, a little back and forth strut. But yeah, it's often a male with a few females watching him to see if he's worthy of being their mate. So,
and he has that kind of, call, right, Margaret? There's that kind of I'm not sure I can do it, but kind of a call, right?
Yeah, that's called a peat. Little nasally sound. You don't usually hear that during the day, but you'll hear that in the evenings before they do. They have a few different things they do. They do the peep, they do the aerial flight display, and then they do the little strut.
Yeah, they shoot up in the air, and then
a wave of the males to advertise to the females how fit they are to be the parents of their young.
Yeah, Phil, you got to get out and experience the entire mating dance and call and flight. It is really neat. Go ahead, Jillian.
I was just going to say, I wonder, the other thing that the woodcock will do is they stomp the ground to kind of stir up the worms for eating. So it's possible, too, that he might be seeing that as well. So they'll rock their bodies, they shift their weight and from foot to foot, and that kind of prompts earthworms and other food to kind of make a sound that the woodcocks can hear or feel, and then they can grab a medium.
Fair point, Jillian. All I think about is the mating dance, so I'm glad you pointed out that they do eat on occasion at this time of year. All right, let's take another call. John is joining us from Moortown. Hey, John, what's going on?
Morning. We just moved to a house here in Moortown back in November, so we did a lot of clearing, et cetera, et cetera. Now the birds are back, and we put out a couple feeders. Have you ladies ever heard, or could you identify the sound? It is a distinct ticking. It's like, it's a ticking. There's no tweet to it. There's no music to it. Is that a bird, or do you think it's an insect?
Give it to us one more time, John.
Like it's like a tick.
All right.
Do you have red-winged blackbirds in your yard?
I haven't seen any yet. Good question, because usually that's a great harbinger of spring. You know, we have the normal bunch of songbirds, you know, chickadees and nuthatches and juncos and some goldfinches.
Mm.
But I haven't seen any red-winged blackbirds or heard them.
Okay, because they do have kind of a clicking noise as well as their typical three sound. Then I'm wondering, it's not like a woodpecker pecking a tree or something.
No,
like that.
We're really familiar with those guys and gals.
All right.
No, it's a ticking, but I just thought I'd throw it out there.
Jillian, what were you thinking?
I can't think of it of what it might be either, but I'm going to make a recommendation, which is, again, you have to be, you know, into having a phone and apps on your phone. But Merlin, so just spelled like the bird, Merlin, M-E-R-L-I-A-N. The Merlin app out of the Lab of Ornithology has a really awesome feature now where you can record a sound and
it
will help identify the bird for you based on the sound. So Merlin app has been a visual ID. You could, you know, enter where you are, you can upload a photo, and it will give you a handful, like, suggestions of what bird it might be. And then they were beta testing this sound feature and released it last year. And it's getting better and better. And I, especially in spring or even during the fall, when there are birds making unusual sounds or their hormones aren't quite right and their songs are a little off, I find it really helpful. And so that would be one to go ahead. And not that, again, it's not 100% always accurate, but I find it helpful. So that might be a thing to try.
All right.
Yeah,
Merlin,
that's a great tip.
All right.
Well, I appreciate your help, folks.
Thanks, John. Thanks for the call. During the course of the morning, you've mentioned eBird. You've mentioned Merlin. Margaret, where can people go for resources to learn more about the migration, birding, what we see in Vermont, you know, how to do it well? Where do you like to send people?
Well, there's so many resources out there. There are great websites on bird ID, which one, All About Birds is one. Audubon also has a bird identification website if you want to learn specific information about specific birds. Those are great resources. We also, on our Audubon Vermont website, have a lot of information on the programs we do to protect birds, both breeding and during migration, all the habitat work we do to make sure they have the habitat they need when they're here breeding and also the habitat they need when they're migrating through so that they can put on all that fat that we talked about during our call today. So it's hard to really say. You can go down a huge rabbit hole. So,
yes, indeed.
Topic you're interested in, maybe start with Audubon Vermont's website. And it will take you to some of the work we're doing and then sort of send you on your way to some individual bird information. if Jillian may have other ideas, but that's kind of what I'm thinking at the top of my head.
Jillian, anything to add?
Yeah, that's, I mean, the Audubon website, the Audubon ID, All About Birds, eBird Merlin. Another really cool website is Birdcast. And so that's actually a website you can go to and see bird migration forecasts, maps. Mm. And so they actually, it will show you, is tomorrow going to be a good day to get out and look for birds? And even for certain species that I'm moving through. And that's part of, I mean, what I find so awesome about spring is it's a time of year birds are slowly coming back, and some of us might be a little rusty with our ID and our birding skills. Mm-hmm. And so as they're slowly coming back, we're tuning, getting tuned up again, watching the birds come back, and there's no leaves on the trees. A little later on when they're establishing territories, the birds are singing. And so this is, in my opinion, the best time of year to be getting out and birding. And yeah, the bird, that bird cast will help you predict when are good mornings to get outside.
All right. Now, Jillian, Dwight wrote us and said, what's the authoritative answer for whether or not you can rescue a fallen nest with chicks? We had a robin's nest fall in a storm a couple years ago from a crotch in a downspout. Two hatchlings were hopping around the driveway. Mom or dad were going crazy, so I put on gloves, carefully put the nest back snugly, and placed the hatchlings in the nest. Was my effort for naught?
He probably didn't have to do that. typically, the answer is leave baby birds alone. Even if they have fallen out of their nest, especially for me, the fact that they were hopping around,
yeah,
that is an instance where you do not need to pick up baby birds. The parents will go to their young, and they will usher them to a safe place and feed them wherever that is until they're able to fly. And so, yeah, he didn't need to do that, but
nature will take its course. All right.
Yeah.
I think we're going to have a very familiar voice here. We've got Joel joining us from Colchester. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning. Enjoying the program. And great. A simple question. When can we expect the hummingbirds to be back?
All right. Thanks, Joel. Margaret, hummingbirds, when do they clock in here?
That's a good question. I'm guessing we want some flowers to be blooming by the time they get back here. So I don't generally see them until my service berry starting to bloom, or some of the early blooming flowers. So I'm guessing probably not until early May, but I don't know exactly when they come back
either. All right.
But yeah, because they're nectar feeders, they're not going to come back until there's food for them to eat. And so we need to have the nectar present before they arrive. So they're probably moving along up the East Coast as the flowers bloom south of us, and then gradually as flowers bloom here, we'll start to see them. You know, and that varies quite a bit here in Vermont. One year we might have apples blooming in early May, and one year they might not bloom until the end of May. So they're a little bit more flexible with probably how they arrive just because they're such specialists on that type of food.
All right, Joel, be patient. They're headed your way, but probably not for at least a month. Let's head back to Bristol. Fred, our Purple Martin friend, is back. Fred, what's up?
Hey, I appreciate the Purple Martin comment. What I wanted to ask the guest speakers about was double-crested cormorants on Lake Champlain. There's not a lot of evidence that they impact the fisheries population, although some people would say differently. But I just wanted to point out the habitat destruction on the Four Brothers Islands, and I'd venture to say that if those islands were closer to Burlington, that something would be done about the cormorants. And I know they're owned by the Audubon Society in New York, but I wonder what our counterparts on the Vermont side think about cormorants and what's going on and the state of habitat destruction on those islands.
Thanks, Fred. Jillian, can you comment on those double-crested cormorants?
I'll actually do that, Rick, because I did my master's thesis in double-crusted corn.
Oh, that's excellent.
But they're not.
Good.
Time ago, in the late 90s, when they were really exploding in the lake, the population was growing exponentially, and I studied the fish, and Fred is right, the impacts on the fisheries are not, it's disputable, but not as concerning as maybe the habitat destruction. So Vermont, what Vermont did in response to a lot of the studies on cormorants is that they basically tried to restore the Vermont islands where they were nesting. So they removed the cormorants from the Sisters Islands where they were nesting, which is up off Grand Isle. And they, I think, as a whole, in partnership with New York, the Four Brothers are owned by the Nature Conservancy. They decided that the Four Brothers were the place they were going to allow cormorants to nest. And so there has been a partnership working with the two states to determine kind of the ideal population level that we want, that the states want in the lake, and where they were, are allowing them to nest. And the Four Brothers is the place they've decided that cormorants can nest. And, yes, there is habitat destruction because the guano from those birds causes all the vegetation to die, but we've determined that that's where cormorants can be, and a lot of other species contribute to that as well. Gulls also nest on those islands, and their guano does the same thing.
All right.
Hopefully
thanks.
That answers the question, Fred.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, I was out with some buddies the other day. We were talking about different birds, and I was doing that cormorant thing, you know, where they dry their wings. And I'm doing it right now here in the studio as well. Margaret Fowl.
Okay, this time of year, they're actually pretty beautiful. If you get a good
yeah.
They
yeah.
They're blue eyes, and their crests are, they're called double crested, but you don't always see that every time of year. They've got these very thin feather crests. And since it's the breeding season, the sort of everything is on steroids, and it looks pretty cool if you get a good look at a cormorant at this time of year.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's Margaret Fowl, Audubon Vermont conservation biologist. Also, Julian Liner is Audubon Vermont's conservation director. You can learn more at vt.audubon.org. Julian, Margaret, I want to thank you so much for the gift of all this wonderful knowledge this morning. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having us,
Rick. It was great.
All right, take care. All right, we've got top of the hour CBS News up next. Then we'll be back to hear what's going on around the world and the country from national correspondent Bob Ney. And we've got the afternoon news service today at 4. That's followed by the Brady Farkas Show at 5:30. Then Jazz with George Thomas at 7, 9 to 1, Eye on the World with John Batchelor. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs, including Healthcare Today and The Brady Farkas Show, on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We have national correspondent Bob Ney with us to get some perspective on what's happening in the world this week. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick.
Bob, still stateside?
I am stateside Saturday morning after 2 years and 5 months. Our visas are on again for India, and so I'm going to hop across the pond. I am going to arrive and see where I'm at, how many cells. I'll email you how many cells I can get.
All right, we'll see. We hope to hear from Bob once he's in India, but we'll have to play it by ear for now. Let's start with Ukraine, Bob. Now, you know, war is inherently brutal. Why are the scenes that we're seeing and the stories we're hearing from Ukraine, why do they seem more disturbing to us than normal?
Well, you know, you're right, Rick. I mean, war is horrible, and we had situations in Afghanistan. We had situations in Iraq where there was friendly fire when we first went over there, where we accidentally killed our own, you know, military were killed, and they took steps to prevent that. And then there were some incidences where a wedding was hit. I think it was in Afghanistan. Right. those things have happened. They're sad. They're tragic. But, you know, it doesn't happen on a daily methodical plan basis. You know, for the most part, we don't obviously plan to bomb a wedding. What is going on in Russia is complete disregard, completely, of what they're hitting. The Ukrainians, Rick, have actually marked out on the ground, and it says children are here. The building's bombed anyway. Over 500 apartment buildings, hospitals, maternity wards. The railway station was bombed just yesterday. So it's, you know, Putin is paying attention to nothing when it comes to human rights. And now, this is historic. Twice has a country been thrown, Rick, off of the United Nations Human Rights Council, Libya, and now Russia has been, eliminated from the council. So, you know, even the UN is recognizing that, you know, this has gone way beyond any acts of war. This is just total rampant aggression against the Ukrainian people. It's a genocide.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that Human Rights Council, Bob. What is it in the first place, and what kind of impact, how important is it that someone gets thrown off it?
Well, it's a Geneva-based Human Rights Council, of course, the United Nations headquartered in New York. But the Human Rights Council, you know, for years has tried to obviously champion, you know, the human rights of individuals on the planet. And they want a spotlight. And anytime there's some type of civil rights, human rights violations, then they approve investigations, you know, to look into it. And it does do, the Human Rights Council of the UN does periodic reviews of human rights in all situations in countries. You know, they'll look at Iran or Saudi Arabia, who at one point in time was throwing people off buildings, you know, because they were gay. So they'll look into those types of things too. But in this case, there was actually a move by us to have a vote to throw Russia off of that. And the vote, of course, was successful.
Mm. All right. During all this, there's always someone looking to take advantage of a situation, and scammers are doing that. In what ways are we seeing that happening, Bob?
Well, yes, you know, there was a, you know, entire series of articles and actually warnings that scammers were out there due to this, which is, you know, it's sad. Yeah. They latch on to breaking news events, and then they post, you know, help, let's help the Ukraine. And of course, you know, they will get money for that. So they had a detailed report they released. I think it was yesterday. And Facebook was describing incidents in which people were profiting. They lured visitors to an off-site, and they posted like gaming videos, et cetera, and some of them from the Ukraine. And then they switched them and lured them to an off-site. And then they tricked people into obviously giving them information or, in fact, maybe money.
Mm. And Bob, the other thing you looked at is how Americans' attitudes have changed towards Russia in the past month and a half. So how have things changed here as far as the perspective of Americans?
Well, now, and this is kind of, I guess, naturally assumed that more Americans view Russia as an enemy following what Putin has done in the, you know, in the Ukraine. Now, one nice thing is that Democrats and Republicans have found common ground for the first time in years. Yeah. 72% of Democrats have a, you know, obviously a bad opinion, and 69% of Republicans all agree together that Russia is the enemy of the United States. And 70% of everybody that has responded, no matter their background, independent or whatever, has considered Russia to be an enemy. In January, Rick, 41% of Americans considered Russia to be an enemy. Today, it's 70%. So obviously, you know, it has grown. And a vast majority, obviously, are, you know, holding this view.
Yeah. All we needed was a good common enemy to come together finally.
Right.
And exactly. We are united United States. I don't mean to make light of what's happening in Ukraine.
No, but it's true.
Yeah. Let's turn our gaze towards the Supreme Court and big news this week for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson.
yes, you know, she was confirmed, and she's going to become the 116th Supreme Court Justice. And, you know, she was confirmed 53-47, so there were three GOP senators who crossed over. Mitt Romney, of course, he said the other day he would do this. Mm-hmm. Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. So there were three votes. I thought it would be three or five votes, but Lindsey Graham kind of got angry because another Democrat from his state, Childs, he wanted her. So he kind of, I thought he would have maybe been a vote at one point in time. But there's three votes for her. And I really don't think that the hearings were contentious.
Right.
I watched them. Some questions were raised. But, you know, some of the members said this was an attack on her. I just didn't see it as, you know, one of the most horrific committee right. hearings of the decade.
Yeah. Yeah. It got heated, but I have to agree with you. Mm-hmm. You know, we see that just in just about every one. There's some that push it a little further and, you know, sure. might be out of bounds, but it happens, and in the end, for the most part, we get to know this person and this justice. And congratulations to the new judge, the new Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. I want to ask you about Mitt Romney because, you know, he really has become kind of the great conciliator there in the Senate. Any thought that he might run again for the GOP nomination for the presidency?
I don't think so. I would say that, in fact, I would say he won't run at all. You know, he can stay in the Senate for about as long as, you know, he wants to.
Yeah.
As long as the voters keep sending him back, which I think they will. They know his position has been a moderate on certain things. He's very conservative on other things,
sure.
you know, which Utah tends to be also.
Yep.
So I think he stays there as long as he wants. But I just don't think that Mitt Romney will get into the fray again
yeah.
of a whole presidential election. I just don't, even if Trump gets out. Now, if Trump gets in, definitely Romney will not run.
All right. And what about your man there from Ohio who, you know, in 2016 put on a good run, John Kasich? What's he up to these days?
Well, you know, I've known John forever, and I actually did tell him, I don't mind sharing this, John and I shared a county in Congress. We had Licking County. He had half. I had half.
Uh-huh.
John was, let me just put this, because he's a friend of mine, but he was aggressive. You know, he would say things that, you know, I wouldn't say it as aggressively as John would.
Sure.
And then when he ran for president, he kind of became really nice. And I told him, I said, you know, John, this was the time to be more Trump-like than Mr. Rogers, is what I had joked him. He could take a joke. But I thought he did a decent job running
yes,
for president. I really did. He was very thoughtful, and he, you know, was out there. I just don't see it happening, though, again.
Yeah.
I don't think that John Kasich will run.
All right. And we saw a much warmer, kinder, nicer Bernie Sanders run for president than we see on a daily basis in Vermont. So that does indeed happen. Just want to bring it up one more time. This is probably the last time we'll ever speak about it, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
Build back better, Bob.
Oh. You know, I served with Chuck Schumer in the House, and he's in the Senate. He's the Democrat leader. And if I bumped into Chuck today, Senator Schumer, mm-hmm. I would say, Chuck, stop it.
Yeah.
Stop the madness. You remember the lady that did the exercises, stop the madness?
Yeah,
well, I would say stop the madness, because what they did was Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, very clearly in the spring of last year said, I'm not supporting Build Back Better America bill.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't listen. They tried to run ads. They tried to do this pushing. So then they got a hold of Senator Manchin about a week ago, and they said, hey, how about parts of this? And Senator Manchin said, okay, you know, I'm willing to basically sit down and talk about that. And as soon as that happened, about one day later, Senator Sinema, a Democrat from Arizona, who has been a holdout on a few things with, mm-hmm. You know, with Senator Manchin, in closed-door meetings and with supporters and says, you know, with supporters and things, says that it's highly unlikely she would support any of it.
Yeah.
So even if they do get Senator Manchin, they don't have her. It's kind of time to say the bill's dead. Move on to some other things. Maybe you revive it later in some lifetime here.
Bye-bye, BBB, is what we're saying.
That's it.
All right.
It's official.
National correspondent Bob Ney. Hey, thanks for joining us this morning. Have a great
trip.
Thank
you so much.
All right.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break and then return to talk with Allison Novak of 7 Days about the University Mall in South Burlington. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Last week at this time, we spoke with Ken Picard of 7 Days about Mighty, that wants to take on Amazon locally. Now we'll discuss brick and mortar retail with another 7 Days reporter, Allison Novak, as we discuss South Burlington's University Mall. Allison, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me.
Allison, first of all, I want to thank you for taking one for the team and hanging out at the U Mall for this story, because nobody hangs out at the mall anymore. Describe what it's like these days.
So, yeah, I actually had a lot of fun. I spent 3 days, well, a couple hours each of those 3 days at the mall, just chatting with folks who were there, both shopping and working there. And, you know, it's an interesting place. It's kind of a mishmash of run-of-the-mill chain stores like Victoria's Secret and Hot Topic, and also just these kind of scrappy little independent stores selling custom T-shirts and, you know, strange assortments of antiques and, you know, UVM merchandise. They also, when I went on a Saturday, there was a big trading card show there. So I got to talk to a lot of the folks who were working at the trading card show. And, you know, I got interested in reporting on the University Mall because I have a 12-year-old son, and he's a Pokemon fan. So we had been spending a lot of time going to the mall to get him Pokemon cards. And I kind of, you know, I started to think, what's up with this mall? This is kind of an odd place. And that was kind of the seed for the story. And then it just so happened that kind of as I started looking into it, the mall was sold to out-of-state developers. And so it became kind of more of a news story as well.
You described it in the story, or used a term in your story, flea market. And judging from the pictures that are posted, the well-edited video posted on your website, that seems really appropriate. You know, why did it have that feel of a flea market to you?
So, you know, there are quite a few stores that kind of, like I said, are just a very odd mix of items. So there's one store in particular called the Hodgepodge Emporium. Mm-hmm. That's the space where the South Burlington Library was for a couple years as they were constructing a new library. And essentially what it is it's the person who runs it calls it a small business incubator. But essentially what it is people rent little booths in the store. I talked to a guy who rents half of a booth for $100 a month, and he paints little miniature figurines that are used for Dungeons & Dragons and other tabletop games. And, you know, he uses it as a workspace as well as a space to sell his goods, although he said sales have not been super good. But, you know, so essentially it attracts kind of a wide array of people that maybe, you know, this is $100 a month is a pretty good deal for a workspace and a place to sell your wares.
Yeah. I use it for my watch guy. Obsessed with watches. I have about 50, so whenever I need a new battery or a band, that'll get me in. I might pick up a soft pretzel at Annie's. But who's been running the mall since the owners defaulted on a loan a few years ago?
So since the owners defaulted in 2016 on the 90-something million dollar loan, it has been run by a special servicer, so a company based in Florida, and they tried to put them all up for auction in 2018, right before the Target and the H&M moved in, but the offers that they got, they deemed too low. So it wasn't until this group, Taconic Capital, based out of New York City, and Eastern Real Estate, a real estate developer in Boston, came in and offered $60 million that it changed hands, and that just happened at the beginning of March.
There were plans back in 2016 that were kind of rolled out, at least ideas, for the mall. What were they? What was going to happen?
So I believe Sonara Properties, they were the owners, had wanted to kind of turn it into a mixed-use development. So, you know, to have restaurants and kind of places where people could walk around and fire pits and retail and possibly some housing as well. And they kind of had these big plans, but right after they presented those big plans to the South Burlington Business Association, a couple months later, they defaulted on the loan. And so those plans kind of went poof. And so now I think there is some hope that these new developers, these new owners, are going to create some type of mixed-use development that would maybe include some of those components that the previous owners had talked about.
Gotcha. Now, as you mentioned, it's been a few years since Target moved in. Has that created any kind of mojo and helped the other mall tenants?
You know, I asked a bunch of them about that, and some of them did say that they saw kind of an uptick in traffic once Target moved in, but it was also the pandemic. So I think, you know, there's probably that also was a factor maybe in keeping people away from the mall for a while. But, you know, in talking to people, they said they felt like since things have started to open back up, they have seen also more traffic in the mall over the last, you know, month or two, as people are kind of going out more again. What's also interesting is there's a lot of kind of collectible shops in the mall, so places that sell, you know, sports cards and, like I said, Pokemon, Yu-Gi-Oh, those types of cards. And a lot of the owners of those shops told me that during the pandemic, people got into collecting because it was something that you could do at home, and it was, you know, like a pastime that they might have had when they were kids. And so almost that nostalgia creeped in, and so people kind of got more into those things and started coming and, you know, frequenting the shops that sold those things.
Yeah. Now, Allison, one of the most bizarre aspects is the food court that at one time was a hopping place, and it's where I'd go. My local Taco Bell fix was there, but yo quiero no bueno no más. What's going on? What's left there in that food court?
So there's two. Well, there actually might have been one that moved in since I reported the story, because I think there was a place called Island, like a jerk chicken / kind of tropical islandy place that was going to be coming in April. But the two restaurants or the two eateries that were there when I went were Roman Delight Pizza, which is a franchise, and then a frozen yogurt place. And so those were the only two options in the food court. So the food court is kind of sad looking. You know, when H&M moved in, people pointed out to me, I hadn't quite realized it, but they took a whole section of where the food court was. And so there was basically half of the food court was kind of wiped out by H&M coming in. And so that space no longer existed, but there were quite a few bays in the food court that were just kind of boarded up or empty and a little bit sad looking.
Yeah. Well, your picture of the pizza place, it looked like he was ready for a really big day. So maybe, you know, there is some eating going on there. There are also rides for the kiddies. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so there's a guy who runs a business called the Big Blue Trunk. His name's Mike Randall, and he lives in Milton. And he does birthday parties, that kind of thing, for kids. And for about 5 years, he's had a spot in the mall where parents pay $5, and then the kids get unlimited rides on his Big Blue Express train, which is kind of this funny train that basically just weaves around, you know, trash cans and people in the mall, and he hides little like fairies and little animals in the bushes, in the potted bushes in the mall for kids to look for. So, and then he also created this swing he calls the Twirly Whirly, which is really funny. It's very, like, homespun. It's basically like this pole that has chairs that swing around it, and he pushes it. And so for $5, you know, kids can run and ride unlimited. And I did talk to a parent who said, you know, this is a great deal to be able to come on a rainy day and be able to just take unlimited rides on these kind of homespun rides that my grandson's created.
Yeah, and when Allison says homespun, it is non-mechanical. He runs in the middle, pushes it, and then gets out of the way, and the kids are flying around. Honestly, Allison, some of the photos that accompany your story feel like you're making some kind of bizarro mall movie. The stuff's unreal. There's a sign that says, put the weapons back where you found them. There's the flashing light for CBD products at a Vermont gift shop. So you really captured, I would say, what is the uniqueness that remains at the University Mall. So job well done.
Yeah, I have to give credit to Kat Cutillo, who I worked with. She's the videographer and photographer, and it was great partnering with her, and she's just very talented at capturing kind of the visuals. So I really enjoyed kind of having that accompany my story.
Yeah, and like I said, watch that online. It really is a great job. You can read Allison Novak's story in this week's issue of 7 Days or at 7daysvt.com. Allison, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's go hang out at the mall, said no one in the last 10 years. All right, let's take a break for the news, and then we'll return to hear what's on your mind as we open up the phones for the first time this week. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
All right, I'm clicking. You can tell when I get real loose, it means open phones. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. And Danny, take the call block off. Open up those phones, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Baseball season has begun. Sox and Yankees get started this afternoon. So if you care to make a prediction on the Sox season, phone on in. Have they made the moves they need to make in the offseason? Is Chaim Bloom a guy who makes all the right micro moves? And, you know, that means they don't have to make the big signings. They did make one, Trevor Story. Is that enough? And if you're a Yankees fan, of course, we can talk Yankee baseball as well. On a ride up 89 last week, in rapid succession, I spotted some fun vanity plates, and you all know how much I like those, so I'll tell you about them. But if you've got one or have one in mind that you've always thought about getting, you can let us know. We've got some information on what you can do to get a vanity plate. And, of course, we were talking birds this morning. If you've sighted any, you know, you've been out birding and saw some neat things already, you can call us and tell us. And, of course, it's open phones. So it's open season on all subjects. We're at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Batting leadoff is the Duke of Newbury, Mr. Fred. Hey, Fred.
Morning.
Morning.
It's interesting. Now we know what the Russian army is all about.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, Russia doesn't even have an army. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And the reason why they don't have an army is because corruption is so perverse in Russia. Everybody tries to screw everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable. When I was in the army, we got paid in cash. It was weird. They had $5 bills, $10 bills, and $20 bills. And if your pay ended in a $1, $2, $3, $4, they transferred that to the next to the next paycheck, so you'd eventually get your money back. And there was absolutely no corruption. There was, I mean, I never seen so much cash in my life until then.
Mm-hmm.
When we were waiting for pay, they had a table, and the table was just packed with five, tens, and $20 bills.
Wow.
And nobody got screwed. Mm-hmm. Absolutely nobody got screwed. And that's because if you think about it, there's absolutely no corruption in the United States. There isn't any. It's obvious. When I was working in the restaurant business, I'd ask people from Eastern Europe and Asia, I'd say, what was the biggest thing you realized in the United States? And to the person, they said, there's no corruption in America. And they're right.
Yeah.
There's no corruption in America. Would you agree?
Well, Fred, you know, this is one call. This is going to be very rare where I agree with you 100%. And, you know, I go back to a book I read, I think it's probably about a year ago, but it was Midnight at Chernobyl. And now that's going back to the 80s, but still in the Soviet era, and talked a lot about exactly what you're talking about, and was one of the reasons that they had problems with the quality of, you know, what they used there at Chernobyl, and supply chain problems. And it was that corruption that was in the system in the Soviet Union at the time. But I think what you are pointing out and what we've seen on the ground with the Russian attack of Ukraine is ineptitude and poor quality. And there's a lot of that still left over because of the corruption in the system in Russia from the Soviet era. So, Fred, I'm going to have to agree with you.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it, you look at this country and you say, oh, there is corruption. Yeah, we do have corruption, but what happens? We come down hard on it, don't we?
Right, we do. Yeah.
I mean, you really get kicked around if you're corrupt.
Yep.
So,
all right.
I mean, that makes a big difference.
I agree. The Duke is 100% right. You can take the rest of the week off and enjoy your weekend. Thanks, Fred.
Okay.
All right, take care. All right, on to Randolph next. We go to Bobby. Hi, Bobby.
Hi. I'm not going to hit on corruption. I'm going to hit
That's
on
fine.
Sugar.
Sugar, okay.
Yeah, people who have tea and coffee every morning and cereal really get burned out by the chunks and stuff that get into it.
Mm-hmm.
Try sticking your secret sugar bowl into the refrigerator when you're not using it. It keeps the sugar from clumping up.
Ah.
Think of
a great life
sugar hack. Think of sugar as snow. When
right.
it gets warm, it gets moisture around the crystals.
Right.
And then when it gets cooler, it hardens up, so it causes it to build up like a chunk.
Oh, very interesting. Bobby, if...
And so...
Now, I'm not... I think sugar, if you looked at it under a microscope, now maybe I'm confusing it with salt, but is in, like, absolute little perfect cubes, if I'm not mistaken. And... that they do clump up, and then, boy, I can remember, you know, you'd try to stick a spoon in some of the sugar bowls that my mom had, and be like, and you're grinding away there. Now, the worst offender seems to be brown sugar. That clumps up badly. Would that work
That'll
as well?
That also works.
No kidding.
We use brown sugar on like oatmeal and cream of wheat and stuff like that in the wintertime. So I just stick bag and all in the refrigerator, and it works great.
Oh, Bobby, that's a brilliant life hack, a sweet life hack from Bobby and Randolph. Do you have any others for us?
Not right now.
All right. Well, thank you for that one.
You're welcome. Yep. Bye-bye.
Keep the sugar in the fridge, and then when you need it, let it warm up just a little, and then, it's like snow crystals. All right. I like that. All right. Let's see. Let's talk about vanity plates. I'm driving up I-89 the other day, and this is what started it. I passed a vehicle, and it really got me laughing. And the vanity plate said, vanity. Someone in Vermont is driving around with an actual, an honest-to-goodness vanity plate because it says vanity on it. Now, I'm not sure I'd shell out the extra cash, you know, to have a plate that says vanity, but it was quite funny. And I drove by this guy laughing, and I wondered if that was the reaction this person gets all the time. But there is a vanity plate, a honest-to-goodness vanity plate in Vermont that says vanity. The very next vehicle that I pass has just four numbers on it. And it's 2022. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, like this is the car of the year. Now, a lot of those number plates are, you know, kind of handed down, especially the two digit, maybe three digit ones. The four digit, you might be able to pick ones now. I'm not completely sure. People can correct me. And I'm just wondering if like this plate has been in the family, you know, since 1968. And finally, after all these years, the 2022 plate, you know, has some relevance, you know, for the next, 8 months. The 2022 plate is, and again, it was a Vermont plate, driving around thinking, look at me, man, I got the plate of the year. And then about three cars later, I was laughing again. I don't think this was a political statement. The next vanity plate that I come upon was donkeys. I think it was someone who fancies donkeys. Might even be that place over in Addison that has the miniature donkeys. I think they still have it there by the little airport over there as you head towards the bridge on 17. But anyway, I saw a vanity plate that was indeed vanity. 2022 plate, and then the donkeys plate. And so a few things I want to talk about. I still have my Vermont Strong license plate on the front of my vehicle, and I just saw one this morning. Someone else does, and it has been, 11 years since Tropical Storm Irene, which is when they came out, but I think they are still legal all this time later. To have them on the front of your car. I don't, you know, it expired and then it was re-upped, but, that is still happening. And then, here's what you should know about vanity plates. They say, above all, avoid using characters that are offensive and vulgar. And there's a great piece, in 7 days. We talked to Ken Picard months ago. You can find it in his WTF column about some that have or haven't been approved. It says, secondly, include up to 7 characters on your standard plate. Disabled plates will require up to 5 characters. Thirdly, use up to 4 characters on vintage and antique license plates. And what you have to pay is $48 plus your normal registration fee, which is, 60, 65 bucks. So then you add 48 to that each year to have your vanity plates. You have to fill out an application, and it has to be approved by the DOT or DMV. DMV would do that, and you can get your vanity plate. But you can't get one that says vanity because that's been taken. And I don't think you can get Jesus because I've seen that one driving around Chittenden County too. So, and let's head to Cabot. Talk to Michael. Good morning, Michael.
How are you, Rick?
Good. How you doing?
Pretty well. So two vanity plates. I was 20 years ago. I had a 1975 Gremlin. I was probably about 19 or 20 years old. And I was able to get the vanity plate Gizmo.
Oh, nice.
From the movie Gremlins.
Yep.
So that was that one. And then my mother, her favorite color is purple, and she had her car painted at one point a paint color, plum crazy, and was able to get the vanity plate PLMCRZY for plum crazy.
Oh, I love it.
And she can be, you know, she can be a little wild back in the day. So there was that to be said as well. So that's all I got on that.
Well, let's talk about the Gremlin. So my first car was a 1969 Rambler American. Ramblers became AMC, American Motor Corporation, which made, all those great, automobiles like the Gremlin, the Javelin, the Pacer. Do you remember the Pacer, Michael? It was like
I do not remember the pacer, but it was kind of I think I've seen a picture of it. It was kind of like a had a really square sedan style outlay on as far as like the cab structure, if I remember ever seeing one.
It had a lot of glass. It looked like a fishbowl on wheels. You got to look that one up. And the other one was the Hornet, which looked like a normal car. The Javelin was actually kind of sporty looking, long and you know, kind of thin and kind of neat looking. But the Pacer was the one that really kind of broke the mold for AMC. So take a look at that. And if you can find one, I might drive that bad boy around. That'd be a lot of fun to have. I love the Gizmo car, though. That's great. My brother had a Gremlin, so...
Oh, it was a fun car to drive. I think they had a straight six in them, and I think mine was a manual. I only had it for a few months, but it was a great car to get around in. It was in good shape.
Yeah, I love
it. Not easy enough to get in and out of for the people riding in the back seat. But.
Well, that was a thing for a while with the two doors. It was like, how do I get back? Yeah, just hop in. You had to climb in pretty gingerly there. So, thanks, Michael.
Yeah, have a good day, Rick.
All right, take care. All right. Another one I saw, so Plum Crazy, that's good with the woman who loved Purple, his mom. And then Gizmo was a Gremlin, which if you remember the movie Gremlins, Gizmo is one of the Gremlins. I saw one this morning on the way in, and it was kind of a nice use of French. It was on a newish, it looked like a really nice new Jeep. And the vanity plate was Mon Jeep, M-O-N, my Jeep. So well done, mixing in a little French, you know, because we are so close to the, Quebec border. You know, I feel like at some point, if we secede, Vermont secedes, and if Quebec secedes from Canada, we will probably become one great nation of Quamont or Verbeck, and we'll all become Verbeckois or Quamonters. And of course we'll have a lot more poutine, here in, Verbeck or Quamont, whichever, we become. I just hope, what's her name doesn't sing the national anthem for us. The, favored singer of Quebec. You guys know her. Anyway. I don't want to besmirch her singing ability. It just doesn't resonate with me. But anyway, someday we will become one great nation of Verbeck or Quamont. All right, let's head back to the phones, and we've got Dave joining us. Good morning, Dave.
The Pacer. That was the car in Wayne's World.
Oh, it was. Yes, it was. Oh, yes, of course. It's another great movie reference.
Yeah.
The Pacer. Yeah. Have you ever seen one, driven one?
No. My first car was a Dodge Dart.
Oh, nice. What year would that have been?
It was the late 60s model.
Oh, my goodness.
Early 70s, yeah.
Yeah. Boy, that's the second Dodge Dart reference in 2 days. You know, some people from my first radio station out in Ohio, someone had a Dodge Dart back in the day, and we were talking about it, about different things and mentioning cars, and she dropped Dodge Dart. So that's wild, the Dart. Yeah. It was a nice little car.
Yeah, it rusted out pretty badly, though.
Yeah, yeah. They resurrected the Dart in when, like the 2000s maybe? Or
Right? Yeah, I've seen that more modern look.
Yeah, it didn't have the same character as the rusted-out Dodge Dart of the 60s.
Yeah, well, I definitely wanted to call in to drop in that.
I love it. Wayne's World is where people can see the Pacer might remember it from. Well done. I remember when it came rolling out, and you said, what do I think about that? Well, it's different, and AMC was always doing something wild and different. Hey, Dave, thanks for that.
Okay, yeah.
All right. All right, the Dodge Dart, the AMC Pacer. AMC did some wild things. Then I think they became Eagle Celine Dion. That's who it is. She would be singing our national anthem if we become one great nation. I don't want to besmirch Celine. It's just not my cup of music. All right, Dante, that's the end of the week. It's upon us, so shut the phones down. We're going to call it off here. The jam is called off. That is our show for today and for the week. Rod Viewpoint, of course, directed by Danny McGivergan, who does a fabulous job. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, and feel free to suggest topics or guests. You can also listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint or sign up subscribe to the podcast at WDEVradio.com. It gets delivered to your inbox, to your email every single day. The Vermont Viewpoint podcast is sponsored by The Warren Store. Funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. And then opening day baseball, 12:05 is when the broadcast starts, 1:05 first pitch. I'm Rick Sengary. I will meet you back in Plainfield on Monday when we broadcast live from Plainfield Hardware.